community-based radio station with all kinds of support. You know, the people who support KPFT are all different stripes of people. And I just feel that's really important for the plurality of our society. So I see KPFT as kind of a shining light that we can all turn to, you know, not just for entertainment, but for information and for perspective and for clarity.
Listen for Grant People's music and other local artists here on KPFT.
Hi, this is Marina Rocks, and you're listening to KPFT Houston.
Below Your Knees by Ray Lynch, and that tells us that it is 6 p.m. Wednesday and time for So What's Your Story, the only program originating in Houston devoted to storytelling. We are aired only on Houston's community station, KPFT 90.1 FM here in Houston, or kpft.org HD1 on the internet. I'm Mary Edgerton, tonight's host, and along with the best team on radio, including our producer, Hank Rubicek, we celebrate the power of story by placing the spotlight on tellers whose story take us on fascinating journeys before returning us safely to the present. Here we are, finishing out the month of March, which is Women's History Month. I decided that for my Women's History show, I would take a different approach from ones that I have taken in the past. Instead of talking about women in history, I decided to invite several women to tell stories from their lives. After all, part of making history is telling stories about yourself and your family. I have invited two wonderful guests that you have met before, Nadia Hakim and Sneha Desai, to share some of their stories about their lives and their families. I've also added a couple of my own. Let's start with my first guest, Nadia Hakim. And I am really so excited to see Nadia Hakim, even though we're seeing our electrons and not our person, not our complete molecules here. But when I invited her to come on, because she is one of the great and powerful women storytellers that I know, Hank, our show's founder, mentioned to me, oh, he says she told a wonderful story at the winter storytelling concert, I guess is what you'd call it, story winter concert. And he said, got it.
So, yeah, I had the pleasure of telling this story back in December. And, you know, I love that it resonated with Hanky so much to where he recommended it. So,
oh, can I just interrupt?
No, absolutely.
I've never heard anybody call him Hanky, but I'm going to start calling him Hanky if it's okay with you. Obviously, that's a very personal thing, but I kind of like it. It softens him.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. He just has, like, such a stern look. Yeah, he's definitely a Hanky.
Hanky. Yeah. All right.
I'm sorry, Rubicek. That's right. It starts off with my sister and I were taking piano lessons at a community center. I'm probably about, you know, in the fourth grade, and my sister's maybe first grade, second grade. And, you know, we're learning really basic things. And of course, my parents, whenever we have guests over, they say, all right, you've got to play a couple of songs. You know, they put us on display. So I remember the first time, you know, my grandfather, he was visiting from Iran, you know, him and my grandmother, they come over, and of course, we've got to play a couple of songs. And my grandfather, we call him Baba June. Baba June patiently waits for us to finish our songs, and he applauds, and he says, "Can you play Jingle Bells?" And Nika and I, my sister and I, are like, "Yeah, that's an easy one, Baba June." And we play it real quick. And, "Can you do it again?" You know, and we play it again. And, you know, he would walk off and he would be singing it, you know, "Jingle bells, jingle bells, jingle bells, jingle bells." He never like really knew the words. He just knew "jingle bells," right? So he would just repeat the words "jingle bells" over and over again to the tune. And he would go about his day. He would go, you know, inspect the gardens, you know, the yards and everything, and tinker with, you know, a cabinet door here and there, and just humming along. And as like eventually my sister and I, we started going to real, you know, to like more professional piano lessons, right, that were longer than just 10-minute increments and for free at the community center. So the songs we were playing were getting more complicated, and they were getting longer and faster. And, you know, when we would play for people who came over now, it was, you know, "Look how fast I can play. And look, this is a waltz," and, you know, all this stuff. "Oh, I can play Farelli's." And my grandfather, whenever he would visit, he would patiently wait for us to get through our impressive songs. And he would have his request, "Can you play Jingle Bells?" and we would start, you know, at this point, we're getting kind of annoyed. Like, we can play so many other cool things. What is his obsession with Jingle Bells? And also we started realizing, you know, they don't do Christmas in the Islamic Republic of Iran. Why is this such a thing? Where did this even come from? And eventually I get busy, you know, when I get to high school, and I stop taking piano lessons, and my sister eventually goes all the way through. She ended up majoring in music and, you know, focused on the piano and voice. And yeah, just every time he came over, that was his request. And two things ended up happening when I got to college. And the first was my relationship with Christmas music got very complicated because I started working at the Houston Galleria to get through school, and they would start playing Christmas music from, I think it was like the second week in October all the way through the end of January. And the boutique I worked at would, you know, that we got the songs from a satellite that corporate beamed in, and it was the same 40 songs on loop every time. So I, like, to this day, I cannot listen to the Jackson 5 Frosty the Snowman. Like, there's just no, when little Michael hits those notes, there's a visceral reaction. I can't do it. It's been years and I can't do it. And so whenever I wasn't at the gallery, whenever I wasn't at work, I wanted nothing to do with Christmas music, understandably. And yeah, it was that. And then the second thing that kind of happened during college was, you know, my grandparents start having to go to more doctor's appointments, right? They get older, they've got more things to check out. So I had volunteered for, you know, a shift of taking grandparents to the doctor's appointments. And I was sitting in a waiting room with Baba June and Mama June, my grandmother. And on the screen, it's a recap of the Jimmy Kimmel show. And it was the episode where Charlie Sheen was on there, and he waltzes on, you know, on stage, and he plants a big kiss on Jimmy Kimmel's mouth. And my grandfather just recoiled. If you could see it in his face, just like the utter disgust. And he just, you know, even if it's a joke, that's the worst thing you can do. You know, it's supposed to be a man and a woman. And he continues on and on with it. And I had come out to most of my family at that point and all of my friends. But obviously not my grandparents and select aunts and uncles. So without realizing it, Baba June had driven a wedge between us. It was very much, oh, I don't want him to ever have that look towards me. I will hang out in the back of the closet whenever I'm with him. I'll just start limiting, whenever I go for lunch, we're going to be there for an hour and a half. That's it. I'm just going to have minimal interaction. The years start flying by, and at one point, Baba June is in and out of the hospital. And we actually kind of had this theory that maybe he's doing it to get away from my grandma so he can watch whatever he wants on TV and he can eat whatever he wants whenever he wants, because my grandmother is very, very overbearing. So there was never any sense of urgency. Every time you went to go visit him, he was watching Animal Planet and like kind of, just in his own little world. And after a few months of this, I get a call that, Baba June had passed away. And it was November, and we have the services, and I remember crying, but it was because everyone else around me was falling apart, right? My father was a complete wreck. His brothers were a wreck. And I just felt like such an immense helplessness that I was crying out of frustration. But as soon as services were over and things were kind of getting back to normal, everyone started getting back into their daily routine of work and everything. I said, all right, well, I'm not going to stay still for too long to where I can think about things. So my friend had invited me out to Pakistan. She said, hey, we're going into wedding season over here. You should come over, hang out with me for a few weeks, bring your camera so you can photograph some of these weddings. I said, all right, let's do it. And I get there and every wedding has like five events, right? It is intense. Like wedding season in Pakistan, we've got nothing on it over here in the States. Like there's just nothing to compare to it. And it's back to back to back to back. And I'm like, this is great. And the best thing is it Islamic Republic of Pakistan, no Christmas music. I don't have to worry about anything. This is going to be great. And we get into like a slow moment where, oh yeah, we've got a couple of days where we don't have any events. We should do a spa day. So we go to this spa and they just threaded my eyebrows and they just exfoliated me and they put on these like plastic bags and filled it with paraffin wax and had sealed them on my hands and feet. They had slathered this clay mask on my face and they said, all right, well, we're going to be in 20 minutes, back in 20 minutes, just sit tight. And they leave and they shut the door and I'm starting to focus on the surroundings in the room and there's a trickle of a fountain that I can hear and then I can start picking up on the music that's playing and I immediately bolt up and look around the room because like is someone screwing with me right now? Because it's Frank Sinatra's version of Jingle Bells. And I'm expecting to see Baba June there, and of course he's not there. I'm like waiting for to see him just like humming along, and he's not there. And for the first time in weeks, I have to confront my own grief. Right? I'd gone around the world and tried to fill my mind with so many other things, and I couldn't hide from it anymore. Right there I was in a spa in Pakistan, and like, what are the freaking odds, right? And that's where I started the process of grieving, and not just the loss of my grandfather, but the loss of being able to be my full self and let him know who I really was, and that stalemate on our relationship that that we had put up unknowingly. It was really powerful in such a random area. And I just started sobbing, which is really hard to do because like the clay mask had started hardening, and like I couldn't wipe it because I had those stupid mitts on my hands. So I'm sure when the attendant came back, they're like, "What happened?" But it was exactly what I needed at the time, you know. And it's been years, but you know, I've gotten to a point where I can start listening to Christmas music again. And even when I hear Jingle Bells, right, I think of him quite fondly. And when I'm tinkering with things around the house, and when I'm out in the garden and all these things, I've gotten to a point where I'm able to think of him in the way that I want to, and without such a tremendous amount of guilt.
Oh, lovely. And I'm sorry you weren't able to have that conversation with him before he passed away. But you've had the conversation with him in spirit now. And I believe in this Jungian world where when someone dies, there's some of them left within us.
Mm-hmm.
And that we can communicate with that peace that was common between us, that was our intersection. And so I believe you've communicated with your intersection with him.
Yeah, I like to think so also. Yeah.
It's good. You know, in my family had a break in relations. My father, I believe my father was terrified when any of us married, because his mother and father divorced in the 1920s, and it was so traumatic that he carried that pain and through his life, and we felt it even though we never met either of the grandparents. I think my sister was 6 weeks old when my grandmother died, and
my wow.
grandfather had died before then. So he didn't speak to my sister for, gosh, how many years? 10 years or something after she got married. But he finally made up with her. Not only that, he told my brother-in-law one time, you know, I think you're the best one of my in-laws.
Dad.
Yeah. Dad. Yeah. And so it happens. So I believe in your intersection. Jingle Bells comes in and y'all are happy.
Yeah. Yeah, I like to think so.
But that is a beautiful story.
Indeed. That was a beautiful story about Nadia's grandfather and how much he loved Jingle Bells. Woven within that, of course, is how much Nadia loved him. I'm going to bring on Sneha Desai now to tell us another story from her family life. Many of you know Sneha as a Moth Story Slam winner and a frequent guest on our show. She is going to share with us a story about her family history. Sneha, welcome. Please share your story with us.
So I grew up in India, being raised by both my grandparents and my single mother. And my grandfather is the one who influenced me the most with his storytelling. He would read me stories every night. He would share stories with me every night. He used to pay me to read stories every night. And one of the stories that he shared with me had a huge impact on me. I don't know if it's a true story or he made it up, but it was a beautiful story about a god coming down to earth from the heavens in the form of a human being. And he went to a poor couple's house and asked for food. Now, this poor couple They had already finished dinner. They did not have anything left but a cup of milk. And they told this god, which obviously they didn't know it was a god, that they didn't have much to offer. And God said, "No problem. I will be happy with just a cup of milk." And he had some. He set the cup down and he said, "Can I please have some more?" Now, this couple got very concerned because they had already told him that they didn't have any more. This guy clearly looked either very hungry or thirsty, and they felt really bad telling him they didn't have any more, but they repeated themselves. And he said, "What do you mean? You do have some more here." And he pointed at the cup, and the cup had automatically refilled, and there was more milk in there. And so this couple was very confused, but they went along with it. And God had some more milk. He set the cup down again and said, "Please, can I have some more?" And this went on and on for the next few minutes, where he would ask for some more. The couple would feel bad saying no, and the cup would automatically refill. He would have some more milk, and they would be left confused. After a while, God revealed to them and said, "I just want you to know that I am God that came down from heaven just to test human beings to see how kind and compassionate you can be. And you have passed my test. And so, as a reward, I'm going to give you this cup that will never be empty and you will never go to bed hungry." And poof, he disappears. And when my grandfather told me the story, I started believing that this happens in reality. And I started becoming very alert and vigilant. As I went about my life, I would look at other people and try to do a little mini investigation in my head. Are these human beings or are these gods testing me? And I started putting on my best behavior and I tried to be as kind and generous as I could be. And then as life progressed, I started noticing that my grandmother was an extremely kind person. My grandmother had gone through a lot of hardships in her life. She had had several miscarriages. She had given birth to three children, and only one had survived, which was my mom. The other two passed away before they even turned 5. And I know that this must have been really hard on her growing up in a society at that time where people were having multiple children and large families. Also, not having a son in the Indian society was kind of shameful because in that generation, and even now, there is a lot of who is going to continue our family name. And so I'm pretty sure that that was hard on her, but yet she never let anything faze her. And after my mom got married, which I heard that my grandfather spent a lot of his life savings on that, as do a lot of families in India. My mother, she had a very unhappy marriage with her in-laws harassing her to the point that she had to leave their house and come back to my grandparents' house while she was pregnant with me, which also could not have been easy on my grandmother because in India, divorce separation is looked down upon. And that is not something that a family can live with. Their name is tarnished. It's very shameful and embarrassing in the Indian society. It still is to some degree, but at that point, it was even more. And yet, my grandmother did not have any resentment, anger, bitterness. She still continued about her life, being kind to everybody. She was still very well liked and respected in society. And as a young child, I had the intuition to recognize that this woman is doing things that probably are kind of unhuman, and therefore I came to the conclusion that maybe she's some kind of divine personality. When I was 12, my grandmother was diagnosed with cancer. And I saw her crying that day when she was diagnosed. And it was the first time that I wondered if my grandmother was actually a human being and not a goddess, because how could a goddess, have such a serious illness and also be crying about it? But the adults were very hush-hush, so I did not have much information. I just knew that my grandmother soon started chemotherapy, and very soon she started losing her hair. She was weak. She was bedridden. And she could not help but stay in the bedroom the whole time. Now, at that time, there was no technology, there was no Alexa, there were no cell phones. I don't think there was a landline connection in the bedroom. So if my grandmother needed something, she would have to call out for us, but she did not have much energy for that. So we gave her a bell to ring, and this was a bell that we had bought in London just 4 years before she had been diagnosed. It was actually a souvenir. And we gave her this bell, and we told her, anytime you need something, please ring this bell. We noticed that she never rang the bell. I think my grandmother felt like she did not need to disturb anyone. She didn't want to be a burden on anyone. We lived in a small apartment, so it was easy for us to pass by her room or go check in on her to see if there was something she needed. So I think that that also kind of helped her with not having to ring the bell. One afternoon, my uncle, that she was very fond of, her sister's husband, was visiting from another city. And she loved cooking his favorite item for him. It's called puran puri, and it is a sweet paratha. It is filled with sweet lentils, sweetened with honey and jaggery and cardamom. And as far as I can remember, this item was made only when that uncle visited, and he perhaps visited like 4 or 5 times a year. And so on that day, obviously, my grandma couldn't cook that meal for him because she was kind of weak. But she gave instructions to the cook that we had hired on how to make that dish. And as we were eating lunch with her in the bedroom, and my uncle, my grandfather, my mom, and I at the table, we heard the bell ring. And all of us suddenly stopped eating because that was a sound we had never heard. We were very concerned. We ran into the bedroom, all four of us, to see if she was okay, like what had happened, because how did this woman ring the bell when she knew that we were eating lunch? Because she's not the type who would disturb us. And all she had to say was, "I hope that you're eating well. I hope that the cook made it exactly the way I wanted her to. And please definitely have seconds, because I'm not there at the table to offer you seconds." And at that time, my 12-year-old heart was filled with so much admiration and respect for this woman. And I started wondering one more time if she was not a human and truly a goddess. A few months later, she passed away. Her cancer had actually been in remission, but she was diagnosed with jaundice, much after she had contracted jaundice, and she could not survive the jaundice, and she passed away in the hospital. And I was very traumatized by the way it all happened. I was not prepared. Also, a part of me was very sure, and maybe this was part of my grieving process, that she was not going to pass because she was a goddess, and gods don't pass. They just kind of reveal that they're gods and goddesses, and then poof, they disappear. My grandma did disappear, but she did not disappear like a god or a goddess. She disappeared like a human being. And at that time, I made a vow to myself that I am going to be like my grandmother for the rest of my life, as far as I can help it. And I am trying my very best to be like her, no matter what challenges come my way, no matter how many hardships I experience, and no matter how unkind someone has been to me, I try and put all of it up with a smile, and I try to never let my light be dimmed. Thank you.
You are a goddess. In every sense of the word, you're such a wonderful person. You do wonderful things as a therapist. You've shared wonderful stories with us about that. And this is a wonderful story about your grandmother. How do you?
I wish that I had had more time with her because she passed when I was, she passed the week of my birthday, actually, December 22nd. And my birthday is December 26th, when I was just shy of, being 14 years old. So, I was still very young at that time to comprehend much the gravity of the situation and all of that until she had passed. So I wish I had a little bit more time to spend with her and to let her know that I loved her. But I truly think that she's watching down on me, and I hope that she's proud of me.
The love that she gave all of you in making sure that this dish was there for your uncle, and then making sure that you all were feeling the family joy and connectivity that she would have given to you comes through in this story. That she rang the bell to make sure that you all felt that connectivity as though she was there. And that's really amazing and beautiful. I have to share with you, I did not know any of my grandparents. Actually, neither did my siblings. My oldest sister was 6 weeks old when both my maternal and my paternal grandmothers passed away, and the grandfathers
Oh.
passed away. And I remember when my sister had children and they were interacting with my parents, and she said to me, "I have no idea what this relationship is. We never had it. And it's so interesting to watch." And it's true. So I envy you, but in a very positive way, that you had that wonderful relationship, that you experienced that giving of that older generation.
Yeah, and I think, thank you for sharing that, Mary, because I think that sometimes I forget that not a lot of people on this planet maybe have grandparents in the same country, the same city, the same town. I was fortunate enough to live with my grandparents, even though they have been long gone now, but I know that a lot of people on this planet do not get to experience the love that I did, even if for a short while. So thank you for that reminder.
Oh, you're such a sweet, wonderful person to put it in those words. So, and my daughters also, I was the youngest child and I didn't have children till later in life. And they also missed that grandparent experience. My husband at the time, their father's parents had both passed away. And my parents became very ill and really not engaging as grandparents. And they were about 1 year old. So I just love hearing these stories. There really is something called a grandparent. And you have shared that with us. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, those were two lovely stories of family history told by women. Thank you, Nadia and Sneha. We're going to take a short break for station identification. We are a community-based storytelling radio show broadcast on KPFT 90.1 FM, Houston Community Radio, and anywhere on the internet as kpft.org HD1. Our show, So What's Your Story?, is broadcast every Wednesday at 6 p.m. Central Time. But, as you will hear, you can listen for the show after it has been aired. Yes, just visit our sponsor, the Houston Storytellers Guild, at houstonstorytellers.org, where you can replay any of our previous shows from So What's Your Story? By selecting the radio show tab. Want to become a storyteller? Join the Houston Storytellers Guild and attend their monthly story swap on the fourth Tuesday of the month. Check out their calendar tab at houstonstorytellers.org and grab the Zoom information for the next virtual swap. The most recent story swap was yesterday. Sorry, guys. But check out the April calendar at their website. Block out some dates on your June calendar for the Texas Storytelling Association Conference in Houston. It will be June 21st to 23rd. The theme will be Context, Culture, and Connection. Updates will be posted on the TSA website, TejasStorytelling.com. Check there, too, for a host of other virtual and in-person workshops and performances. We in Texas are enriched with storytellers. The San Antonio Storyteller Association sponsors a monthly story night. It is on the first Wednesday of the month at 7 p.m. Central Time and can be found online at YouTube Live on their channel, San Antonio Storytellers. And don't forget the Moth in Houston. They have a story slam the second Tuesday of the month. The next one will be April 9th at their new venue, Warehouse Live Midtown at 2600 Travis Street at 7:30 p.m. The theme is green. Check out the moth.org live storytelling events and their Facebook page, The Moth in Houston, for updates on their event and to buy tickets. So now let's get back to some storytelling. I want to share with you one of my own stories. It is one about coming of age and being with my mother as she passed away. I have to tell you that I never thought of myself as one of my mother's favorite children. In fact, maybe her least favorite. She and my father waited for 6 years for their first child. How could my oldest sister not have that aura forever? Next came my brother, the only boy. Finally, me. Destined to be a repeat as a girl. However, oddly, in some way, I know more about my mother than either my brother or sister. She shared her deepest secrets with me. Her first love, whom she had hoped to marry. He died in World War II in the Philippines after having been a prisoner of war for 6 years. She gave me his photograph and the death notices. Her diary, which admittedly I finally cut the lock off to read, she left to me also. It had her dreams in high school. So in the end, she left me her most valuable possessions, her stories. This next story is one of my own, not about the stories she passed on for me to me. Those are for another time. And in fact, I want you to know that I make a point of passing them to my children so that they know about their grandmother. But this story is about how she trusted me to help her pass from this life.
I'm the baby of the family, or let me say I was the baby of the family. There are three of us, my oldest sister, and if you looked at one of those picture dictionaries for children, next to big sister might be a picture of a concentration camp director. The next is my brother, might be a picture of a collaborator. And then there was me. And I just was always the baby of the family. And I thought I grew up, and I got to be 37. I was on my second marriage and pregnant with my first child. And I called my parents to say, hey, I'm having a baby. Now, my older brother and sister, and my brother's only 2 years older than me, and my sister's only 2 years older than him, they had had children maybe 10 years before, and it was all, oh, give us grandchildren. So I call my dad, and I say, I'm having a baby. And he says, oh, my God, I got to sit down. I wasn't ready for this. And then my parents were getting older. I'm in my 40s, and we go to talk to them about their family will. You know, my dad's one of these Texans who's like, my mother wrote it in her own handwriting on the back of an envelope. I'll write mine on the back of an envelope. And we said, you know, I think maybe that worked for your mother, but these days you might need a handwriting expert. Why don't we get you a real will? So my brother had taken his handwritten will and took it to a lawyer here in Houston, and my sister had been the executrix on the handwritten will. And by the time we got to the family reunion to talk about it, my brother was the executor. So there was this thing going on. Remember, I'm in my 40s. There's this thing going on. And they finally decide, okay, we'll be co-executors. And I'm like, and what about me? You know? I mean, I'm not that far behind you. How come I can't be a co-executor? You know, it's kind of like, you're the baby. And I admit that I had a nighttime bottle. I'm not sure if it was till I was 5 or 7. I think I might be getting Alzheimer's. Yeah. And I believed in Santa Claus till I was in the 6th grade. But, you know, some of us late bloomers actually mature by the time we were in our 40s. So my father had become ill, and he had died, and my mother was living actually here in Houston in independent living. And I was living in the Northeast. I mean, when you're the baby of the family, sometimes you have to run away to feel like a grown-up. So everybody else is in Texas. I'm up in the Northeast. And I am down in Texas for a meeting, and I get a call from my brother. I was actually going to come over here to Houston and visit my mother. And he said, just want to let you know, Mom wasn't answering the phone this morning, and I let myself into her apartment. And she was lying on the floor, unresponsive, and I'm following the ambulance now to the hospital. I said, okay. And I'm a physician, I should add this piece. And so I called my sister who lives in San Antonio, and I said, you know, Jane, I think we need to go over there. And she's like, oh, you know, I'm at work, and you know, you have to take a lot of time. I said, Jane, your mom is going into the ICU, and something's wrong with her. I think now's the time to go. Okay, my concentration camp director? Yeah. And so she and I drive over, and my mother had had a major stroke. She had something called Wernicke's aphasia, where she can't find the word for something, like she would call a watch a rugula. And we're talking to doctors and checking on nursing homes and looking at PT units, and that's Saturday morning to Sunday night. My sister goes back to San Antonio. And my mother, in the meantime, had been doing worse. She would go into renal failure, and they would give her fluids, and then she would go into heart failure, and then they would give her diuretics, and she would go into renal failure. And this is this cycle that kind of goes down. And so Monday morning, my brother drops me off at the hospital, and I walk in, and she had had what we call a nasal cannula for oxygen. And she was beginning to have more serious breathing problems. And so they said, we need to put on what we call 100% oxygen face mask. So I said, okay. And being a physician, I understand that this is not a good sign. And so I said, okay. And they said to me, you know, the next step will be a respirator. I said, I understand. And so I call my brother. I mean, I'm the baby. How can I make a decision? And I call my brother, and I said, you know, the next step would be a respirator, and I don't think she would want that, and I think that her health is not going to tolerate this. And he said, well, you know, they had this other thing. It's called a continuous positive airway pressure thing. He said, they had this CPAP thing that they tried on her. Maybe we could do that. And if you've ever seen a CPAP, it's extremely uncomfortable. So I said, okay, hey, I'm the baby. You're the older ones. And so I came back in the room and I said, why don't we try CPAP? And the respiratory technicians came in with the machine. It's very loud and it's very horrible. And my mother looked at me, and although she couldn't speak, in her eyes, she said to me, it's okay, you can do this. And so I looked at the respiratory technicians and the nurses, and I said, we'll go to comfort care. And I did two things during the comfort care. I knew that my mother was very religious, and they said, yes, she had the last rites when she came in. And I said, I want to see the priest come in and give her the last rites. I just need to see that. And I had brought her this gray silk scarf from Italy because she loved elegant things. And I hadn't been able to give it to her in person yet because of everything that had gone on. So I laid it over her. And I guess it was about 8 hours before she passed away. And when I realized it would be about 20 or 30 more minutes, I called my brother and said, it'll be about 20 or 30 more minutes. He lived about 15 minutes away. And he went through this, we just put the water on to boil for the spaghetti. And I thought, you know what? I'm the baby. I've always been the baby. But in that moment, as my mother passed, and with her permission, I aged out of being the baby.
One last story for you here. We have spent most of the hour talking about the passing of important members of our lives and how we as young women in our families were witness to that. I'm going to switch gears here now because Nadia Hakim has another story for us. Spoiler alert, no one dies. This one is about being the phoenix. It's about rebirth. It's about coming back after a disappointment. Listen and be the phoenix. And may the phoenix of our grandparents and mothers live within us. So you have another story for us about...
it's actually a combination of things. It's about my time when I worked at the elections office. That was one of my first leadership roles.
Now, after you've started this new position or an elected official or before then?
So it was before. When the pandemic happened, I was going into my fourth year at public health. And I decided, you know, being in public health during a global pandemic isn't nearly exciting enough. I should definitely go into elections, like elections administration in Texas. So I was offered a leadership role in their communications department, and it was a relatively new department. I was offered kind of second in command at the communications department for the elections administration. And my director, 2 weeks after I started, was like, well, I'm going to go have a baby now. I was like, I knew you were pregnant. I didn't realize, like, your baby was going to be able to register to vote in like 5 minutes. I don't know what I'm doing. This is my first leadership role. And what am I going to do? And she said, you're fine. Just start with, you know, the press releases. And most importantly, make sure we have all of the positions on our team filled. I trust you to do it. And our team was, I just love how diverse the setup was, because in Harris County, it's so diverse that it's actually a legal requirement that everything is done in English, Spanish, Vietnamese, and Chinese. So your sample ballots, all of your educational materials, everything has to be available in those four languages. So when I was filling the Spanish language position, the person was a recent graduate who specialized in translations from U of H, but they needed a visa to be able to work in the States because their student visa had expired. So we really fought hard to get the first visa sponsorship for a county employee, and we did it. We got it. It was really, really cool. And then, I also hired the Vietnamese language person, and this was someone who didn't get a chance to go to college. She worked in the call center and she worked really, really hard. And she ended up out translating a lawyer from an Ivy League school in her application. And so giving her the call and offering her that job, like I remember I was just bursting at the seams from excitement. And I was able to fill a couple of other positions as well. And it just became this really great team who I was able to get close with, right? They would reach out to me like, "Hey, I think my kid's struggling about coming out. How can I be supportive?" Or, "Hey, I think I might have to have this surgery, this procedure." Just very open and just very wholesome, and there was a whole lot of trust. And it was a new office, it was a new team, and we had to figure out a lot of things. And there were a lot of different legislative changes also that we're trying to keep up with. And one of the kind of byproducts of figuring out like the process of election night and all these things, it was I'm only 5 foot tall, so it would be really difficult to see me in like such a busy setting with, dozens of people running around. So what I ended up doing was I would wear this powder blue boiler room suit, and it had like a royal blue trim to it, but that kind of became my uniform for supply pickup day and election night. And like the staff knew to look for me in this like little uniform. And the appointed board members for the Central Count Board, you have a fit like people who are appointed from both political parties, they knew to look for me in this suit. The media, like the journalists, they knew to look for me in this suit. They're like, "Oh yeah, Nadia's over there." She and it had multiple pockets. And like election night, a lot of people don't realize election day, like everyone's working 24 to 36 hours straight. It is absurd. And so I am carrying around granola bars and a couple of cell phones and like just like pens and highlighters, and like it all fits in the suit. It was a very functional suit, and I think we held like a record 9 elections within 12 months back in 2022 to 2023. It was just absurd. And at 2023, they ended up passing legislation that abolished the elections administrator's office, and they moved things back to the county clerk's office and the tax assessor's office. And shortly after that, they ended up laying off. They laid me off and a couple of other people in my department. And I could see it coming, but I was still, I was still a little hurt by it. But that very night, I came home and my wife was like, "How are you feeling?" I said, "Yeah, we knew it was coming. We could see the writing on the wall, but it's 3 days before my 35th birthday, and Janelle Monáe is in town, and dang it to hell, I'm going to that concert. I'm gonna have the time of my life." And so I put on the baby blue boiler suit, but I didn't wear, of course, I didn't wear my election shirt underneath it and all that. I put some, nipple tape on and like had left it unzipped down to my belly button. I was like, "You know what? I'm gonna make it a little risque. Let's go
You're gonna
crazy."
be Janelle Monáe.
I was like, "I'm out here living my best life tonight. Let's go. I'm gonna you know, there's going to be nice side boob. It's going to be great. And I'm like, it's a queer performer. I am going to run into so many people I know. Like, I'm sure they're going to be exes. I'm sure they're, yeah, I'm prepared for it all. And my wife and I were standing in line to get drinks. And the person in front of us is looking over their shoulder and then finally turns around and says, "You work at elections, right?" It's like, oh my gosh, you are one of the people appointed to the Central Count Board, aren't you? And they were like, yeah, it's so good to see you. And like out of context. And I start explaining, well, I was actually laid off this morning. And I start going down this rabbit hole. And I notice that they're not paying attention to a thing I say. And I was like, I'm sorry, is there something? And she just responds, "Is this blue suit the only thing you own? Because it's the only thing I've ever seen you wear." It's like, dang it. Why did I waste side boob? Of course I would run into somebody at elections. It's not somebody I've slept with in the past or anything like this. It's somebody who only knows me in the context of this suit. Gosh, this is terrible. And I still giggle about it. And of course it's been a few months and there've been a couple of elections since I've been laid off. And in that time, I've in the days leading up to these elections, I'll get photos from my former team members and it's selfies of them in jumpsuits. Like they're wearing their own suits. And it's got, you know, they send it with a text like keeping your legacy of jumpsuits on election night alive and things like this. And I'll run into people out in public and they said, "Hey, you actually came and spoke to my group about the mail ballot changes. And, you know, it really helped us out, you know, when we reached out to like these senior homes and things like this." And it really strikes a chord. And I know when I thought, you know, wow, this is the end of the story. This is the end of my election story. And I was, you know, I was hurt by it and a little bitter. But since then I've realized that, you know, it's nothing personal. And while I was there, I did really good work. And I was able to...
You remembered.
Yeah, right? I was able to build these lasting relationships with people who, you know, who knew what they deserved. And yeah, whether it was a jumpsuit or them inviting me to like a wedding or, you know, asking me to come talk to their group, even though I'm still not, even though I'm no longer with the elections, like it's really something. And it's not the end, right? It's not the end of the story. So,
well, guys, that hour went by way too fast. Thank you to Nadia Hakim and to Sneha Desai for sharing your stories with us. It's time to get back to reality. Now, just because our show is ending is no reason to leave. Stay tuned into KPFT because next up is Living Art with Michael Woodson and Michael Carson, a community art program that hosts artists from around Houston, including poets, writers, performance artists, visual artists, car artists, and others engaged in educating, promoting, and advancing art and artists in our Gulf Coast region. Just chill. Make Houston's community station, KPFT 90.1, a part of every day. And while you're driving home or just hanging, join us every Wednesday at 6 p.m. for So What's Your Story? It's a great way to make the commute go by. Keep loving great stories, and we'll keep bringing them to you. This is Mary Edgerton, and along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, we never want you to forget that even if a story doesn't end the way you want, remember, it's the journey and not the destination. Be the phoenix. Peace.